We have made it, folks. Welcome back to the Chaos Ball Podcast, the last Chaos Ball Podcast before the 2024 MLB season kicks off. Technically, it's already kicked off. The Dodgers and Padres have started the season already in Korea, but season doesn't start for me and you listening to this until the 28th when the Mariners play the Red Sox in Seattle. They opened the year with a 7-game homestand, which is cool. Love that. Against two American League adversaries, the Red Sox and the Guardians. And they actually have, just looking at it right now, a really tough April. Pretty tough April, and I'll get into it a little bit later in the episode, but start of the season I feel like is crucial this year. But this is the Mariners preview. You saw that in the title. You clicked on this podcast to listen to it. Whether or not you listened to the other divisional preview podcast, this is obviously a little bit different. This is just on the Seattle Mariners, the baseball team that plays baseball in Seattle professionally. I don't know if y'all are aware. They have a baseball team up there. And while the divisional previews are fun, and I like doing them, and I hope any of you who listen to those enjoyed them, this Mariners preview and the season podcast in season, this is why I do it, man. The Seattle Mariners, this is why I'm here doing this podcast, for better or for worse. But how this episode is going to be structured a little bit, the start of this episode, I'm just going to kind of paint with a broad brush up front my thoughts on the offseason, the general team construction, the team vibes, the front office, the ownership, everything really going into this season. I'm going to talk about a little bit what I think are the keys to the season, and then I will get into more of kind of what I did with the other divisional preview podcast, focusing on the projected opening day lineup, the projected opening day rotation, the bullpen, and then get into the more nitty-gritty of the depth in this team, the prospects that might impact the team at a major league level this year, the team X factor, the current injuries, just all that. Probably going to be a fairly long one. I have a lot to say about this team, but up front, I generally think the offseason went well. It was a weird offseason. It started off terribly. Couldn't have started off worse. They missed the playoffs by a very narrow margin, and then Jerry says those things that he said and whips the fans up into a frenzy of fury. And as the offseason rolls on, the moves are slow. There's not much going on, and then we arrive after so many moves, and we knew there were going to be a lot of trades. It's Jerry DePoto and the Mariners. We knew there were going to be trades aplenty, and trades there were, which I will talk about. And throughout the offseason, I had various podcasts this offseason, both recapping the moves that they made and just talking about where I was at that point in time in the offseason, and it was pretty bad vibes all around from the fans for most of this offseason. And then now, heading into the season, I think vibes are better. I think there was a switch this offseason from lots of hate directed at the front office to lots of hate directed at the ownership group. I think it's fairly clear to everyone and most fans that the ownership group, John Stanton, the face of it, but you know, he's merely the face. There's a lot of people behind this ownership group. I think there's definitely a consensus among the fans that they are holding the team back from really going out there and spending a lot of money to really win a World Series. I don't think they really care much about that. And that doesn't exonerate the front office from criticism. It doesn't. But I think it's definitely an important aspect into looking at why the team does the moves they do. And I've talked about this before. I think Jerry DePoto is a GM that the ownership group loves because he can operate with a limited budget. He's shown that he can. I think it was pretty clear this offseason there is a budgetary ceiling that has been set on the front office with a no going over it rule. And you saw the maneuvering. It was a million moves to move one in. Like, it was so many moves to not even do that much in the grand scheme of things this offseason. Particularly before the Polanco trade, it was kind of just shifting a bunch of stuff around to cut costs and position themselves, I don't know, a little bit more set up for the future, and like in an effort for quote sustainable like competitiveness, which I think is just a shitty way of saying we want to be pretty good for a while and not actually really go for it because our ownership won't let us. I don't know. I think there was a lot more hate towards ownership this offseason than the front office. Last offseason, it felt like there was equal amounts of hate for everyone involved in the organization. But this offseason, especially with some of the more cryptic comments that Hollander and DePoto have made, particularly in 2023 at the start of the offseason, it was abundantly clear to everyone that, yeah, the ownership is definitely holding the front office back a little bit. So with that thought process, I think the offseason went fine. I think it absolutely could have been better. I think that seeing the Matt Chapman and Blake Snell deals recently has made it a little bit more sour in my mind, because I would have liked Matt Chapman for that price. Even I would have loved Blake Snell for that price. Despite how good this rotation looks on paper right now, I would have loved Blake Snell at that price. Would have made the team better. Doesn't matter about your current rotation capabilities. The Matt Chapman one especially, with the current weird, bad state that the third base position is in going into this year, would have loved Matt Chapman for that price and that contract. And that still feels out of reach for this team to do, which is crazy. I mean, they handed out like their biggest free agent deal to a position player this offseason, and it was Mitch Garver. For what did he sign? What was the Mitch Garver signing? 2 years and like $24 million? That's just the state of the team. And then there was a million trades that happened, so I don't know. I think the team right now, the biggest question is like, oh, is this team better than last year? On paper, this team is absolutely better than last year's opening day roster. And even I'll say the team on paper is better than how the makeup of the team was at the end of the year. I think they definitely improved the offense in places they needed to. I think there's more risk in this team, and the depth is still not quite there for me. But I do think on paper, this team is better just as I'm looking at it. But I think it could still be way better. I'm so tired of having a really good young core on a team and constantly be projected for 86 wins and then going out there and winning like 80, like max 90 games. Because this team was good last year. And I said that in my preview podcast last year. I said, this team is good. Not great. They're good. And they won 88 games and missed the playoffs by 2 games. Their Pythagorean record was 91-71, which makes things hurt a little bit more. And then you go into this season and they're projected by Pecota to go 84-78 and Fangraphs 85-77. And this team has proven to definitely outkick the production or the projection, my bad, the projections in recent years. They've been good at that. But I think there's a reason why they're not projected to out and out win this division and win 95 games, and it's because of the limitations that have been set by this ownership group. And I guess the willingness of the front office to be like, yeah, okay, we'll work within those limitations, no problem, and put a competitive enough team down on paper so we get enough fans, so we can maybe make the playoffs and go on a run. And it's fine. This team is good. I'm going into this year, I'm looking at it again, and I think this is a good team. I think this is a team that, again, can challenge for the division and challenge for the wild card. I'm not super confident to like lock them into a wild card or a division winner status, though, because there's enough risk in this team that things could go poorly this year. Like, absolutely, things could go downhill quick for this team if a couple things fall wrong. And I think that's my biggest gripe with how the team has been constructed the past couple of years. It's been constructed in a manner that relies so much on your best players being available at all times and producing like they need to, like producing like the top end of their projections. They kind of need that again this year. They need it. They needed it last year and they fell short. And you still got great production from that core. And they're going to need it again this year. They need these guys to perform like they think they're going to. And it's just about mitigating variance and risk in baseball, I think. I think there's obviously a lot of luck in this game, but I think making your team better, either with free agents or just aggressively acquiring good baseball players, is you're mitigating risk. Where, like, if, let's say, your best player, Julio Rodriguez, gets hurt, knock on wood, he doesn't, then your lineup won't fall apart if you really mitigated risk in the offseason. And I don't think this team has been good at that aspect of team building. Because, again, they need, I think, like, Julio is going to be a key player for them this year, obviously, because he's the best player on the team. He's a generational player. I love him. I think he's going to produce. He's an MVP. I think he's going to be an MVP candidate again. But it's like there should be more I'm confident in around him if he goes down, and I'm just not super confident, you know? So that's my gripe with this team, is they haven't done enough to limit the variance. Because I want the lower end of their bell curve to not be like an 80-win team. I want it to be like an 88-win team. Like, if things go poorly, I still want this team to win 86 games. And if they go perfect, like the front office has kind of set this team up, I want them to win 95 games. And if things go perfect, I think this team can absolutely win 95 games this year. But again, if things go poorly, I think there's a low floor with this team and a fairly high ceiling. And I want a team that I'm more confident that's going to win 90 games. And I'm just not. But I digress. I have talked a lot about the ownership and the front office this offseason. I don't want to dwell on my thoughts about them. I think they've put together a pretty good team. And how did they do it? How did they put together this good team? Well, through trades, of course. Listen, it's Jerry DePoto. Of course he's going to make some trades. And trades he did make in chronological order. This offseason is an absolute trip. When you just look at where the team was when the offseason started and where it is now and the freaking turnover that this entire team went through, it is bonkers. It is absolutely bonkers because it's a Jerry DePoto run team and no one is safe from getting traded. So I'm just going to list the trades here in chronological order. As they happened in the offseason, I talked about them. My thoughts have probably changed a little bit on these players, but I'll talk about the players specifically more when I get into the lineup and all that and the projections of the actual players. But it started early. It started in November. Cody Bolton on November 2nd got traded to the Seattle Mariners from the Pirates for cash. And then another minor trade. They got Blake Hunt, a catcher from the Rays, and they traded Riley O'Brien to the Cardinals in this trade, as well as Tatum Levens to the Rays. And then these two trades happened within a few days of each other. Luis Urias gets traded to the Seattle Mariners for Isaiah Campbell. And we're like, okay, cool. That Luis Urias, I love betting on him as a bounce back candidate, as a utility bounce back. And then 5 days later, Eugenio Suarez gets traded to the Diamondbacks for Sebi Zavala and Carlos Vargas, an absolute flamethrower wild card from the bullpen and a backup catcher who I think is actually quite solid as a backup. And it was like, oh, okay, we're doing Luis Urias as a starting third baseman. All right. And then, you know, the offseason rolls on. It's December. Jared gets on the horn with the Braves. He says, I don't want Jared Kelnick on my baseball team anymore. And he trades Jared Kelnick, Evan White, and Marco Gonzalez to the Braves for Jackson Cower and Cole Phillips, both of those pitchers out for the year, which is interesting. And Jared Kelnick having an awful spring training for the Braves. That trade, again, could go down as an all-time L for both teams. You never know. But that was like kind of a salary dump slash we don't want Jared Kelnick anymore. You get off of Evan White's contract and Marco Gonzalez's contract, and you give them a, you know, pretty useful player in the squad in Jared Kelnick. And I honestly, I still think this team would benefit from having Jared Kelnick on it, but with the addition of Luke Rayleigh in a trade that, This was the double trade day. We go to 2024. It is the 5th of January, and Jerry Dipoto trades Jose Caballero to the Rays for Luke Rayleigh, who had a fantastic year last year. And then on the same day, trades Robbie Ray to the Giants for Mitch Haniger and Anthony Descalfani. And it's at this time I podcast, and I'm like, okay, love bringing back Mitch. I like getting Luke Rayleigh. I can see that as, at the very least, a pretty useful platoon in the corner. Mitch Haniger had a terrible year last year. I don't think he's that bad. He's just, it's all about staying healthy for him. And then Descalfani is like, cool, that's like a swing man out of the bullpen. That's a mop-up guy, emergency starting pitcher, what have you. January 29th, Jerry Dipoto gets on the phone with the Twins. And he acquires Jorge Polanco, the man who has been, I swear, the Mariners social team has had him mocked in, or photoshopped into a Mariners jersey for years now. He's finally a Mariner. It's been the trade that Jerry's wanted to make for years, and he finally acquires Jorge Polanco for Anthony Descalfani, Justin Topa, Gabriel Gonzalez, and Darren Bowen. And that, at the time, was like, that's the last big trade to happen. The next day, he trades for Samad Taylor from the Royals, who is super intriguing, has had a good spring, and I'll talk about him a little bit later. And then, February 3rd, he pulls out a random trade from his ass, which he often does. Jerry Dipoto calls the White Sox. He trades Zach DeLoke, who just didn't have a place on this roster, and Perlander Barroa. He trades him to the White Sox for Gregory Santos, who is currently a little hurt. And again, I'll talk about him later. But at that time, I was like, oh, I love this. Big fan. I still like it. This is a good trade. And that's it. He traded Darren McCock into the Marlins. I salute you. Triple A King, one of the all-time like pitching leaders in Tacoma Rainier's history. And then recently, March 15th, he just traded for Nathaniel Garabitos, a relief pitcher from the Royals, for a player to be named later. And then he also just traded for a guy like today as I'm recording this, and his name is Ruff Corn, who is a relief pitcher, another minor trade. And that is the trades that he made this offseason. And it's like, okay, you so many moves to arrive at, again, some good players. He dumped some salary for some decent guys. Did he need to? Maybe he needed to maneuver. But, like, I don't think this team needed to get rid of Jared Kelnick in the manner that they did. I don't think they needed to get rid of Eugenio Suarez in the manner that they did. But yet they did it. They did it. They got off of Robbie Ray's contract, too, astonishingly, and essentially just got, like, turned that kind of into Jorge Polanco, which is absolutely an upgrade at second base from where they've been the past couple of years. And then he kind of caps off the trading offseason with the Gregory Santos trade, which I really like. It's a consensus, like, this is great. If Santos pitches this year, that'd be awesome. If he doesn't, that would suck. But I like this trade. He had a great year last year. It bolsters the back of the bullpen. It's funny, like, before that trade, I was talking about the state of the bullpen. I was like, oh, it's a little top heavy. And then that trade happened. I'm like, all right, I feel a lot better about the back of the bullpen now. It's a little bit less top heavy. Injuries going into the year withstanding, I think the bullpen's in good shape. But it's those trades coupled with the free agent signing of Mitch Garver, and they needed a DH, and he also can play backup catcher. I loved this signing. It makes a ton of sense. Loved it at the time. Looking back, still love it. Big fan. And they signed Austin Voth to a major league deal, which I thought was a weird one. They made a lot of minor league signings, a lot of just depth AAA guys. And then recently they just signed Ryan Stanek, out of kind of necessity, break in case of emergency, we'll sign Ryan Stanek to the bullpen because we have injuries right now, and I think he's fine. And that's how you arrive at the team. You keep all of your core guys from last year. The most astonishing thing to come out of this offseason is Emerson Hancock, Brian Wu, and Bryce Miller are all still on the team, which is kind of crazy to me, given where we started in this offseason. Where we started, it was like those guys, I'm pretty sure I said it on multiple occasions that you have to trade one of those guys this offseason. Like, if you really want to, if you really want to go for it and upgrade this offense, you kind of have to trade those guys. And Jerry and co has managed to upgrade the offense going into the year without trading one of those guys. I still think, you know, maybe at the deadline, they might need to be a little aggressive and still end up trading one of those guys. But as of right now, going into the year, I am happy that those three pitchers are still on the team because it gives the Mariners a projected rotation of nastiness. It gives them a, at worst, top 10 rotation in the game going into the year. I think this is a top 5 rotation at least. I think this can be the best rotation in baseball when it's all said and done in 2024. I love this rotation. Big, big fan. And that is just how this team was built this offseason. Now, where do we stand? It's, again, the computers are still saying mid-80s. Why? I still just think it's the depth is an issue here. I guess I'll talk about the bench and the AAA guys a little bit later in this episode. But my keys to the season this year, I'm going to highlight these, and then we'll actually get into the players and what I like, what I don't like about this makeup of this team. The keys to the season, I think the biggest one is a strong April, and that's why I talked about the schedule, because this schedule is kind of brutal, and what has been missing from the last couple of years of Mariners baseball is a strong start. They had to, the past couple of years, the past two seasons, they've had to claw back into a wild card slash division race like post All-Star break. They've done it the past 2 years. They went on huge hot streaks late in the year to get back to relevancy after just kind of kicking the can around being a middling 500 mediocre team until the All-Star break. And then all of a sudden it's bam, it's you win 15 games in a row. Julio has the greatest 4-game stretch in the history of baseball at the plate. And all of a sudden you're back in it. They need a strong April. They need to be a good team out of the gate. And I think they can. I think if any team is built to have kind of an opposite year the past couple of years than they've had of in terms of starting the year hot maybe and then tapering off later because of injuries, it's this team. I think there's a lot more risk of that happening. But I think they're built to start the year well. You're entering the year. Everyone's healthy in the lineup. The bullpen, definitely a little banged up, but all your starters are healthy. They're poised to have a pretty healthy squad to start the year, and I think they need to have a huge April. I think they need to come out of the gate as a serious baseball team and be like, we're here, we're trying to win the division. I don't want to go through 3 months of being 2 games above 500, 2 games below 500, doing that for 3 months straight. I don't want it again. It's awful because all year last year and even the year before, it was like, we know this team's better. We know there's another gear. And then they do eventually hit that. And in 2022, it was just enough to make the playoffs. Last year, it was not enough to make the playoffs. If they have a good April last year and then go on a tear later in the year, they might win the division. It could be like literally the difference in September if they have a really good April. And the schedule's tough. They start with the Red Sox and the Guardians, then they play the Brewers, the Blue Jays, the Cubs, the Reds, the Rockies as a nice respite there, and then they end the month with Rangers, D-backs, and start a series with the Braves going into May. That is a very tough schedule. That is a really, really tough April for this squad, and I think April is just going to be key. I think April is going to be huge for them. I want to see them start the month and win. I don't know. What was it? In 2019, they started 13-2. Do that again. Or 2021, they did that. Do that again. Why not? Just do it. Have a good April. That's one of my big keys. Another big one is just health. And it's true for everyone. I'm not going to specifically say pitcher health because pitcher health is of paramount importance for every baseball team. It seems like every day a new pitcher gets hurt. And thankfully, I guess for the Mariners, it's been confined to the bullpen, even though it's some key arms and Brash and Santos. But their rotation at the moment is healthy. When I say health, I'm mostly talking about the lineup because the key acquisitions of Polanco, Garver, Haniger all have health question marks the past couple years on their careers. There's really no blemish on their production on the field when they're playing. They've all been very good professional ball players when they've been on the field. It's just they've battled health issues. And so I think that's going to be key. I think Garver not having to really catch unless it's an emergency is going to help. Like him being a full-time DH, I think will obviously help his health. He's not going to really have to play defense. Mitch Haniger, I don't know. Mitch Haniger feels like a Franklin Gutierrez-y type of injury guy where he can probably do everything right and then he'd get a baseball to the nuts and it's over for him for 2 months. He feels so unlucky, so I don't know about him. And then Polanco, again, he's had... Like last year, in the past couple of years, has been knee, ankle. He's had a bunch of lower body injuries. So keeping him healthy is also huge because he's going to be super impactful to this lineup in the middle of the lineup all year. And he'll have to be if this team wants to win the division and make the playoffs. So health, again, health mainly of the acquisitions they made is key. Obviously to the other guys, it's huge, but it's just because there's big health question marks on those guys. That's key this season. Another thing that I think is huge for this year is buy-in at the deadline. If this team, I don't care where they're at, to be quite honest with you. I don't care, unless they're like 15 games out and absolutely dead in the water, I need them to be a big buyer at the deadline. Last year, we saw them kind of buy, kind of not at the deadline. 2022, they acquired Luis Castillo in a very aggressive move, and look what happens, they make the playoffs. Last year, what do? They sell. I mean, I said not a couple seconds ago it was kind of a buy sell. It was a sell. They traded Paul Sewald. I mean, they got Rojas, Canzone, and Ryan Bliss, who might be pretty useful this year. Josh Rojas had a decent September last year. Canzone struggled. Ryan Bliss looks like, albeit maybe a lower ceiling guy, but an interesting AAA to MLB player. But that was a sell. You trade your closer who's still at another year on his deal. I'm on record saying businessy baseball wise that is a good trade, but wanting to go for it aggressively and win, trading your closer and really not making any other impactful moves at all is an L and a sell at the trade deadline last year. Like they acquired Trent Thornton, I think, and Eduardo Bizzardo also at the deadline. That was it. They need to buy this year. If their lineup is middling, they need to trade some prospects or a pitcher for some offense. A corner outfielder, perhaps. Maybe a third baseman. I don't know. If they're really depleted in the bullpen, injuries have decimated the bullpen, I need them to buy. They have plenty of... Now the prospects are better graded by a lot of systems in last year. I talked about last year how their farm system was decimated. They just had so many guys that were outside the top 100 that I thought could have made it in this year, and a few of them have. They have plenty of good prospects to trade. They have a decent amount of pitching at the major league level to trade. I don't want to hug prospects in the hopes of being sustainably competitive for another decade. I would like them to trade some prospects to try to win in 2024. I need them to do that at the deadline. If they're anywhere close to 500, if they're a couple games below, if they're 10 games above 500, if they're 20 games above 500, still, I would like them to be aggressive to make this the best team they possibly can after the trade deadline, going into the playoff push. That's huge this year, I think. And they have the prospects to trade. Don't trade all of them, but there's plenty. There's plenty to trade from. And then my last key, and I'll talk about this, I guess, more specifically when I'm talking about the players in a second, but Julio, Julio is the key. Julio is my X factor. Julio is the key to this team. Like I mentioned earlier, the risk variance of this team is still quite high, and it's the lineup, while it is better than last year entering the year, I think, and a little bit more balanced, it's still Julio's offense, and I think it still is going to live and die by Julio. It wasn't that surprising that he kind of had a pretty he was very emblematic of the team last year. He had a sophomore slump type of year until he went on one of the best stretches I've ever seen. He had the four game hit streak, and then basically August and September he was absurd. He was absurdly good. And look at what the team did when he started to play like an out-and-out MVP top 10 player in the league. They picked up around him. And when he was rocking like a 700 OPS going into the All-Star break, where were the Mariners? Where they were like 500. They were an average team. Julio is the single most impactful player to the Seattle Mariners. He was last year. He's going to be this year. They're going to need him to have a good start. The hot April goes along, or I guess not hot April, just having a strong opening to the year is a little bit dependent on Julio because of how they've built this lineup. If he comes out of the gate firing, which I think he will, I feel like he's extra motivated to do that this year, that would be so good for this team, and I think the team would rally around him and also have a hot start. Those are my keys, overarching, my keys to the season. Strong April, health of the acquisitions, buy in at the deadline, being a buyer at the trade deadline, and then Julio. Julio being probably the biggest key to the Mariners' success this year than anyone else. And I'm confident that he can be that dude, but I think it's going to start with a strong opening to the season. I think he needs it. I think the Mariners need it. I think the fans need it. Not to put that much on the guy, but again, it's this front office and ownership that have placed so much responsibility on this 23-year-old man, and he probably has the talent to do it, just a lot of pressure. And that is the episode's not over. That's my broad brush. Those are my thoughts. I'm going to cut it off at around 30 minutes, and now I'm going to probably talk about the players on this team for about an hour straight, so buckle up for that. I'm going to break it down with the opening day projected lineup. This is all according to Roster Resource on Fangraphs. The opening day lineup projection, the opening day rotation and bullpen projections, the projected opening day bench, and then some AAA impact players who might be up and down throughout the year, and then some noteworthy prospects who are below AAA level who could have an impact on the 2024 Seattle Mariners. So without further ado, I will get into it. Let's take ourselves to Fangraphs Roster Resource, and I will just read you their projected opening day lineup for the Seattle Mariners. They've got J.P. Crawford hitting leadoff at shortstop, Julio Rodriguez hitting second center field, Jorge Polanco at second base batting third, in the cleanup spot, Mitch Garver at DH, Kyle Rowley follows him at catcher, Mitch Haniger in right field, Dominic Canzone hitting seventh in left field, starting on opening day, according to Fangraphs. Ty France at first base and Josh Rojas at third base. I don't disagree with this lineup, although I don't think Dom Canzone is going to be the starter on opening day. I think it's going to be Luke Raley. Luke Raley's had a very tough spring, but I guess I should say right now, if you aren't familiar with my game, I don't really watch spring training, nor do I care much about what happens in spring training. Now, I think spring training is good for a couple things. I think it's good to see, like, oh, are your pitchers working on something? Are they working on a new pitch? What does their velocity look like? And then, like, on the hitting side, did they make any tweaks to their swing? And, like, are they hitting the ball hard? Like, I don't really care much about their OPS in spring training. Like, something that's interesting to me is Jung-Ho Lee of the Giants. He hit a ball 110 miles an hour early on at spring training, and that was something I can take away because it's like, okay, we know he has at least the capability to hit a ball that hard. There were big questions about that. And, like, in spring training for the Mariners, it's like Luis Urias has had a really good spring training. Luke Reilly's had an awful spring training. I'm not really letting that affect my opinions on them going into the season at all, because it's spring training. You got to take these stats with a grain of salt. I tweeted out today synopsis. I just tweeted with no context today that Cooper Hummel put up a almost 1100 OPS in spring training last year. He had 40 at bats. He had 4 home runs, 1 triple, 2 doubles, 9 RBIs, 4 stolen bases. He slashed .275, .420, .675 last year. Cooper Hummel, remember him? Yeah. Did that translate to the season? No, not at all. Spring training, largely, I don't care about. It also fought, like, I work a full-time job, and it's usually during the daytime, so, and it's very hard to watch those games a lot. So I don't watch much spring training. I watch some highlights here and there. I tap in to make sure that, like, you know, Luis Castillo is still throwing hard, and he is, so that's good. And really, that is about what I take away from spring training. So I do think Luke Reilly is probably going to end up starting in left field on opening day. I doubt they're going to give that to Canzone. I think they'd be correct in doing that. Otherwise, I think this lineup is pretty much set. I mean, if they'd be facing what, Brian Baio or Pivetta. I forgot who is the opening day for the Red Sox right now, but either way, they're going to be facing a righty. So Josh Rojas will be starting on opening day at third base. And I imagine we'll see a full-on platoon between him and Luis Urias. And then Dylan Moore on the bench with Sebi Savala to round everything out on the bench for this lineup. And I guess I'll start with the good, and then I'll transition to the bad. The good. Top of the lineup, J.P. Crawford. I think it was my favorite part of 2023 was J.P. Crawford's season. Just a phenomenal year. There were definite question marks going into last year of, is he really the best long-term option for this team? I definitely had those question marks, because what he was up until last season was, like, I liked the approach. He walks a lot. He doesn't strike out a lot, but he does not hit the ball hard at all. And if he's not going to be a Gold Glove defender, that's just, I think there's upgrades to be made at the position, but they re-signed him. They put faith in him. He went to Driveline. He made a couple changes, and he put up almost a 5-4 season last year. He hit for a tremendous amount more power. I mean, it was pretty simple what he did. He not only, like, changed the location of where his hands sat and his stance a little bit in his bat, in the box, but he basically just attacked fastballs in the zone a different way. He really just kind of kept his approach, because his approach was already really good. He's a pretty selective hitter. He's a really good eye, and his walk rate not only rose again this year, his strikeout rate also rose, but that came with almost 100 points of isolated power this season. He just kind of was waiting until he got a fastball in the middle of the plate and then destroyed it to right field. I think all but, like, 2 of his home runs were to right field, and the other 2 were, like, center field, just barely. Just a phenomenal year. The metrics on defense do not like him, but eye test wise, I like him on defense. He was very durable. Once he was in this leadoff spot, he did not look back. He was hitting leadoff home runs. He was drawing a ton of walks. I mean, what an absolute amazing season for him this year. The big question is, can it continue? I see that as pretty sustainable, because, like I said, his approach didn't really change much. He was still super selective on pitches outside of the zone and on the shadow, and he just waited for a fastball right in the heart of the plate to crush, and he did. He really did, and it showed in his numbers. 134 WRC plus, 19 home runs. He had never hit more than 10 in his career prior. 172 isolated power compared to hovering around 100 in his career. His walk rate was almost 15%, and his K rate rose to almost 20%, but that's still below league average. I think it's sustainable. I think he's going to do something similar this year. I think his floor is at least, like, guy who can groove a decent amount of home runs on mistake pitches and draw a ton of walks and play fun defense. So just a culture guy. He's clearly one of the leaders, if not the biggest leader / captain on this team. He's one of the longer tenured players and veterans on the team, and it definitely shows. And JP's we're lucky to have him on the squad. And then Julio, I mean, what else can he really do? he had like the quote sophomore slump. Like he was a league average hitter until the All-Star break. And then after the All-Star break, he was an absolute fucking animal and was one of the best players in baseball. And he ends up with almost a 6 F4 season. He really didn't change a whole lot from his rookie season. He was super aggressive. He whiffs on a decent amount of pitches, but when he hits the ball, he hits it so hard. And it really showed in the first couple of months on why that approach can be a little bit risky when you're just missing a lot. But then once he kind of dialed it in later in the year, you couldn't throw him anything in the zone or he'd hit it 110 miles an hour and he sprays it all over the park. And he ends up with 32 home runs, over 100 runs, and 100 RBIs, 37 swiped bags, basically walked and struck out similar, just about the same amount as 2022. And really the thing that took off this year for him was the defense. That's why I think his floor is so high, because at the very least, I think he's going to hit a decent amount of home runs, steal bases, and provide what seemingly is gold glove type defense in center field, even though he didn't win it this year. It's crazy how far he's come. Coming up as a prospect, there were never questions about the bat. It was like, this guy's a corner outfielder. He changed his body up a little bit, showed in his rookie year he can play center field. And then last year he was like, no, I can't just play center field. I'm going to be one of the best defensive center fielders in the league. And he was. I mean, the thing for him to do is really just cut down on the chase rate. He's probably going to whiff a decent amount for his career, just because I think that's just kind of the makeup of his swing and the player he is. But if he just cuts on the chase rate a little bit, I can live with a 24.5% K rate. That's around league average. It's a 6.6% walk rate, where it's like, if he raises that a couple percentage points and raises the OBP to like 350, then we're looking at like a 900 plus OPS guy, which is absurd. What he really should do is what Acuna did last season and cut his K rate in half and hit more home runs and walk more. In a perfect world, he'd do that. But I think this team's going to rely on him to do something at least similar than last year. And I think there's definitely reason to suspect he's going to improve. So there's not much more to say. I do want to emphasize, we're so, so very lucky to have a player like Julio on the baseball team that we root for. If you're a Mariners fan listening to this, which I suspect that you are, we should not take him for granted. And I worry we're going to have this guy and not put 100% effort into winning World Series with him, because he clearly wants it. He's going to get better. He has done everything right so far in his career, on the field, off the field. He's a great dude. He's amazing to root for. We can't take him for granted how special of a player that he is. And I'll move on before I get sucked into gushing about Julio for 20 more minutes. But Jorge Polanco, man. Jorge Polanco in the three spot. I like this. He has had an interesting, it's not directly comparable to JP, but it's a little bit similar. Like the past couple of years, early on in his career, he profiled more as a second baseman who doesn't have a great glove, but had a good approach in terms of low strikeout rate, decent walk rate. And then the last couple of years, he's turned on the power tremendously. A rise in strikeouts has come along with it. But since 2021, in a full season in 2021, he hit 33 home runs. And then in about a full season of on-field play, the last two seasons, he's hit 30 home runs. So his power has improved tremendously. He's walked more as well, put up a lot better just power numbers and RBI numbers. The real thing for him this season, like I alluded to earlier, is staying on the field. If we can get 140, even like 130 games out of him this season, like 2-3 WAR, I think that's a success considering what the Mariners have gotten from second base since Robinson Cano departed the team a while ago. I think we're going to expect at least like a guy who's been around, who's a veteran and a professional hitter. I think, again, that's something that this team has kind of been missing in the center of this order. It's just a matter of staying healthy. And he's a switch hitter too, which really rules. A switch hitter with this much power from both sides of the plate is pretty cool. I'm excited to watch him finally be a Mariner, and I hope we're not getting a Colton Wong type fall off. And I'll leave it at that. Mitch Garver followed up. Another professional hitter. I talked about Mitch Garver. This guy does not chase at all. Talk about professional hitter, professional approach, whatever you want to call it. Mitch Garver doesn't chase at all. He strikes out around league average. He draws a lot of walks, but he's such a mature hitter. Like, he, I think, literally 99th percentile of chase rate. He literally just does not. He's not interested in chasing your silly little pitches. And in 87 games last year, he hit 19 dingers. He caught a decent amount for the Rangers last year, and I think it'll only help his health going forward to be basically the full-time DH. Like, I'd be surprised if he catches more than 10 games for the Mariners this season, considering they have an out-and-out backup in Sebi Savala and Kyle Raleigh, a guy who can play a lot of games. So him being a full-time DH, I think, is best case for him. It's best case for the Mariners. That means, like, there will be probably less cycling of the DH spot like we've seen since Nelson Cruz left. And it's just going to be super valuable to have this guy just right in the middle of the lineup. It adds to the balance. It gives you another guy like JP who can just work the count, get on base, and he also provides a good amount of power upside. I mean, he was a starting DH for the World Series winners last year. He was so good for that team. So same with Polanco. We'll just need him to stay on the field. And then after him in this lineup, it's Kyle Raleigh. And this top five is really solid. I like the top five. JP, Julio, Polanco, Garver, and Raleigh. Because you get Cal Raleigh to knock in Mitch Garver after he's just drawn an 8-pitch walk. I mean, Cal has been just doing similar to what Julio and what we've seen from our pitchers and all these guys who've come up through the system who are still on the team. It's like they've done everything you could ask for. This is year four for Cal. He has only improved every season he's played. He just looks like a guy who's going to hit 30 home runs and provide really good defense behind the plate. And he's going to strike out, but he is somewhat of a traditional catcher, although he switch hits, but he's kind of a traditional guy. He's going to walk a little bit more than league average. He'll strike out a lot, but he'll hit a lot of home runs. And he's a really good pitch framer. Was really good last season throwing runners out, like surprisingly good at that. Not a good blocker, but that's okay. That's like after framing and pop time and throwing guys out, I don't really care if you're a good blocker or not. Maybe he'll improve in that area of his game this year, but I think he's a top 10 catcher at least. I think this season he can cement himself as a top 5 catcher. He's super valuable asset to the team and catches his pitching staff, one of the best pitching staffs in the game, very well. And now after this is where it gets a little dicey. Mitch Haniger. And for the sake of this, I'm just going to assume Luke Raley's a starter in left field. Mitch Haniger and Luke Raley, the corners of this entire team is the problem. First base, third base, left field, right field. First base, I'll talk about Ty France first, I guess. I am buying into the 2024 Ty France rebound, bounce back, whatever you want to call it. This guy had just such a bad season last year for a couple of reasons. And I think it was one of those things, too, where it just started to pile on him mentally. It felt like it manifested itself in infield pop-ups and missing pitches right in the heart of the plate. And I talked about this on an episode last year towards the end of the season on how bizarre his swing take numbers were, because his approach didn't really change much. And he's still like a good hitter in terms of his approach of he didn't strike out a ton last year. He doesn't whiff much. He whiffed a little bit more last year, but he's like fine. His approach is good. He was just missing pitches in the heart of the zone so often. It's not often you see a negative value in the heart of the zone, and some of that was luck. To read you some numbers, he had a .250 batting average last year, .270 expected batting average, and this is the one that's kind of fucking crazy. He put up a .366 slug, which is awful. His expected slug was .420. And he hit the ball harder. He had a better hard hit rate than he did in the previous season. A slightly better walk rate. He was barreling more balls last year. I think he got tremendously unlucky, compounded with just like it wasn't going his way. And things just snowballed into a pretty bad season for him after a really good 2021 and 2022. And I think that's why I'm buying into 2024 at least not being as bad as last year, because he got so unlucky last year and he went to driveline this offseason. He looked great in spring training. Divish said he does gain weight during the season a decent amount too, so it's like that's something to look out for as the season goes on. He said that. But I'm willing to believe in driveline tweaking his swing a little bit so he can do a lot more damage on the pitchers in the heart of the plate, because that's really all he needs to do, because his approach is pretty solid. So I'm buying into the Ty France 2024 season, at least getting back to like two to three war, like a league average first baseman. I like that. And then, man, the corner outfield is just not what it's about on this team. They lose Teoscar Hernandez after a very middling season last year, and they reload in right field with Mitch Haniger and probably a platoon situation with Canzone and or Luke Rayleigh. I think Luke Rayleigh might play some first base this year and probably DH a little bit. Canzone will probably DH a little bit too, because his fielding was a travesty in the short sample we saw last year. It was ugly out there. He looked like an uncoordinated corner outfielder. It was real bad. It was giving Jesse Winker vibes sometimes when I saw a fly ball head Dom's way. But Mitch Haniger, awful year last year. He was not healthy, and when he was healthy, it was terrible. He's looked really good in spring. The stats have been good, but the swing has just looked like his swing. Like, it just looked like Mitch Haniger's swing, and I think that was missing from last season and 2022 when he was hurt as well. So I think best case scenario is he gets back to, again, kind of what Ty France. If he can put up two war in right field, just get back to basically league average production, that is what we want. I think he's going to be better than last season, and it's another one where he just needs to stay on the field. I think he's better than 73 WRC plus like he was in 60 games last year. It's just he's got to stay on the field, and I think at worst he'll platoon, and hopefully he can just mash lefties. And then Canzone and Luke Rayleigh. I'll start with Canzone. I like his swing a lot. He's got a lot of torque. And the scout grades, he's got, like, his best grade is 60 grade raw power. So there's some power to tap into there. The sample isn't big enough for me to really be, like, I don't, like, form a concrete prediction on his 2024. But I think, at worst, he's going to be a fine platoon option to crush right-handed pitching. I think that's what he should at least aim for this year. Because I don't know if he's going to be better than that in his career, to be honest with you. I'd rather he was like the fourth or fifth outfielder on this team rather than competing for a starting spot. But this is the reality that we're in. I think it depends on what we see from Luke Rayleigh, because I'd believe we'd probably see Canzone Haniger as a more of a platoon in right field. And then, as I said, Canzone was so bad in the field, I imagine if Mitch Garver gets a rest, Canzone will be the DH. And then Luke Rayleigh, one of the offseason acquisitions like I talked about for Jose Caballero, had a tremendous year, like a true breakout year last year. The opposite of Ty France, got pretty lucky on his batted balls last year. So I don't think he's like 30% better than league average at the plate. I hope he is. I don't think he is. He profiles as a pretty true three outcome, beefy, left-handed hitting corner outfielder. Like, I think there's 30 home run potential in here with like a 30% strikeout rate and league average walk rate. I don't think that's bad. Not the greatest ballpark to try to do that in. Not the worst ballpark, I should say. Home runs are fine in Seattle. It's like a little bit less than league average park factor for home runs. I don't know. I think he can capture the starting left field spot. If he's close-ish to what he did last season, I think he can do that. He'll have to really show his power wasn't a sham last year. And that's it. I think he got, again, looking at his numbers last year, you'd be like, oh, we got this up-and-coming great corner outfielder. I don't want people to expect that, but I think he's going to be a solid option. I think hopefully he can really just continue to hit for a lot of power. He's a very big boy. He can play first base too. So if Ty France doesn't quite have the bounce back he does, or if they want to aggressively do a platoon in at third base and at first base and in the outfield potentially, they could platoon that at first base, I guess. But I like, at least versatility wise, that he can play first as well as the corners. And then also he can steal some bags too, I should mention. He stole 14 bags last year in 118 games. So hopefully double-digit steals again this year, 10 to 15 to 20, depending on how many games he plays. And I hope he can be a decent starting left fielder. And then the bench, Sebi Zavala. Third base. I've talked about third base. The platoon of Urias Rojas. Josh Rojas, sure. Major league ball player. I think he's going to sport a 720 OPS and play third base and maybe some second base and be fine. Urias, at face value, I liked getting him as just a potential bounce back and using him as a utility guy. Not super thrilled about him playing half his time at third base like he might this year. And he's had a bizarre spring training. Like, reports came out a couple weeks ago that he hurt his throwing shoulder and he couldn't throw to first base. And he's DH'd a lot this spring training and has hit really well in spring training. So the verdict's kind of still out. He's had a bizarre spring at, like, because if he can't play third base, he doesn't have a spot on this team. He has a minor league option, which is something that's at least useful, just in case he needs to go down and DH for the Rainiers while rehabbing his shoulder or something. If he can't throw to first, then Josh Rojas is the starting third baseman with a Dylan Moore platoon, right? I guess I'm not thrilled about third base at all. And I'll move on. I'm just not thrilled about that. I hope Urias can throw to first base. That's all I'll say. Because hitting-wise, it's intriguing. The upside is intriguing, at the very least. He's just been hurt the past couple of years, but he profiles as a hit toolsy second base, third base, just infielder who can hit for good average and has fine speed and play three positions decent. And he did that fairly well in 2021 and 2022, and then last year he was super hurt. At the end of 2022, he was super hurt. So hopefully he can just stay healthy, but he's already not healthy, so who knows. And then the bench, the two other bench guys are Sebi Zavala and Dylan Moore, according to Fangraphs. Dylan Moore, he is out of minor league options, which is something to note. So he'll definitely start on opening day on the bench. Hopefully he can be the Dylan Moore we know and love and play the outfield and shortstop and third base if he needs to, and be a league average hitter. Hopefully his 2022 was great. That was best case scenario for Dylan Moore, I think. Hopefully he can kind of do that. Weird year last year. He was hurt too a lot. It's just if it goes awry and they want to call up a Ryan Bliss or Sam Haggerty or Brian Anderson even, or Samad Taylor, if they want to call up any of those guys, he'd have to be DFA'd. I don't know if anyone would pick him up if he's really stinking it up, but that's just something to note. He's out of options. And then the last bench guy is Sebi Zavala, acquired in the Eugenio trade. Like mentioned earlier, Sebi Zavala doesn't offer me anything at the plate at all, but is a pretty good framer and actually a really good blocker. Not a great guy at throwing guys out, but I think he'll be a pretty stable defensive backup catcher option, which is good to have to catch a good pitching staff like this. I think that's a good thing to prioritize for this team. Whereas Tom Murphy didn't look amazing when he came back behind the plate last year, but was good at hitting. Sebi Zavala is probably going to be the opposite. I think he's going to be a good backup catcher for this pitching staff, and I think that's all you can really ask from him in 2024. And that's the lineup. I mean, again, like I mentioned earlier, it's a lot more balanced on paper last year. It's just about staying healthy. I'm not thrilled with third base or the corner outfields. Those are clear positions that they could upgrade at the deadline, hopefully, if they want to. First base is big wild card with Ty France, but JP, Julio, Polanco, Garver, Raleigh as your 1-5, I think is pretty solid if they can stay healthy most of the year. I think Julio is going to have a monster year this season. I'd just like to see him take some more walks and chase a little less, but that's getting a little nitpicky on our superstar. So, and then in terms of the AAA impact to this lineup, potentially, you got guys in AAA like Cade Marlowe, we saw a little bit of last year. Sam Haggerty still on the team. Taylor Trammell, I'm completely out on him as a ball player at this point. Too many opportunities have been squandered. And then a couple new guys. Samad Taylor, who they traded for this offseason, who had a great spring. He can play second base and the outfield. He is at the very least an intriguing player. And then Ryan Bliss, who they got in that Diamondbacks trade mentioned earlier, another second baseman, infield prospect, like 45 future value, like potentially just kind of a league average to utility platoon bat. Both of those guys, as well as Cade Marlowe and then Jonathan Classe, a prospect who's slowly risen through the ranks that most people probably know about at this point. All of those guys are super fast, which I think, and Sam Haggerty's pretty fast too. So I think at the very least, you have a lot of speed in Tacoma to come up and impact the team, which they didn't have much. They didn't have that much speed last year on the squad. So at least in AAA, they have that going for them. Jonathan Classe is definitely the most interesting here in terms of prospect wise, because he has struck out so much in the minors while hitting for a ton of power for his size and stealing a shit ton of bags. So I do want to see him in the majors this year. I just don't know. The strikeout numbers do not translate well to the majors, but he's an intriguing prospect nonetheless. And then other guys who we could see this year in the lineup at AAA level, Brian Anderson, third baseman. Who else? One more. Blake Hunt, catcher. So if a catcher goes down, I think he will be the first one to get called up. Probably got him. Oh man, where did they acquire Blake Hunt? I am now blanking on where Blake, the Rays? Was it the Rays? Was it a, it was the Rays. Yeah, it was the Rays. It was a trade with the Rays, and I think he went to the Rays from the Padres in the Snell trade. But he's a catcher. That's what I can tell you. And then the noteworthy hitting prospects that, like, outside chance could make an impact on the team later in the year, potentially. And I've ranked them in terms of likelihood of being in the bigs. Tyler Locklear, number one. He raked last year at third base, first base. I think his best position is probably first base. He absolutely raked last year. He's in double A. He will be to start the year. He's an intriguing bat to potentially look out for if injuries befall this team and they need to dig into their prospects. Cole Young, after that, has just been a great shortstop prospect. I don't know if shortstop is his position long-term, but I think he'll at least be able to play second base. Harry Ford, after that, still catcher, verdict's out on if he can be a catcher, but he's so athletic and has a great swing and a lot of power. He could be up on the team this year, maybe. And then after that, the last guy I have on this list is Lazaro Montez, just an absolute monster of a human being. Has drawn Yordan Alvarez comps for good reason. He kind of looks like him. Is he going to be on the team this year? I don't know. Again, it's a big power strikeout type of guy that is just such a risk at the major league level, but I would like to see him hit dingers at the major league level. That'd be cool. But those are the guys I could potentially see coming up from the minors this year. Like guys like Colt Emerson, Ty Pete, I like Feldman Celestin, no chance. Johnny Farmello. The guys they drafted last year, I doubt it. I even like they all, especially Colt Emerson, had a great start to their pro careers, but they haven't really played a ball, professional ball for long at all. They had like a couple weeks of it last year. So unless like Colt Emerson puts up like a 1200 OPS at single A and double A and forces the Mariners to make a decision, then maybe, but I doubt we'll see them. And that is the lineup. It's fine. There's again, places to improve, and I hope they're aggressive at the deadline to go after, if they need to, a corner outfielder or a third baseman. I think the corner outfield they might need a lot more of, but they have less third baseman, so maybe they go that route. It kind of depends on what Mitch Haniger looks like. If Mitch Haniger is just back and he's just needs to be a Mariner to hit well, and he looks like the Mitch Haniger of old, that would be amazing. And maybe they don't need to trade for a corner outfielder, but those are the positions of weakness. I think the lineup, again, is on paper better still plenty of risk, and the depth worries me a little bit. And then I'll move on to really the crown jewel of this baseball team, the pitching staff. And let me just preface this by saying this pitching staff arouses me. This pitching staff they're sexy, man. Luis Castillo, Logan Gilbert, George Kirby. Those top three is genuinely nasty. And then you have Bryce Miller and Brian Wu, and that's your five. And then I will throw in Emerson Hancock as the six here. Not projected to be in the starting rotation. Super, super intrigued to how they use him this year, because if he's just like depth at AAA, I can't imagine he'd be happy about that, but that would be super valuable to this team if he's just like a depth piece. I think him being like, if they just rolled out a six-man rotation to start the year just to kind of lessen the load on these arms for the first like couple months of the season, and Hancock is your six with like Austin Voth as your backup six, like that's kind of sick, dude. But okay, Luis Castillo, we'll start at the top. Luis Castillo, just traded for him at the deadline, 2022, helped lead the Mariners to the playoffs, and then continued just being a consistently great pitcher. Last year, he pitched almost 200 innings, 3.34 ERA, and the peripherals for the most part backed that up. He lost a tick overall in velocity last year, about 0.7 off of his fastball velocity, which is not, I'm not ready to raise the alarm bells. I mean, he's 31. He turns 32 next offseason. So it's not super abnormal, but he's still sitting 96.5 miles an hour on his fastball, and he can definitely crank that up to the high 90s if he has to. So I'm not super worried about that. I'm really not that worried about Luis Castillo at all when he's on the mound. He's phenomenal to watch pitch. I love watching him pitch. His arm angle is so unique. It's just such a whippy sidearm. You get so much arm side run on his sinker, two-seam fastball. Great biting slider. The gyro slider is a thing of this Mariners team. And the gyro slider, and I'll talk about this a good amount more when I talk about Brian Wu, but Logan Gilbert has one too to complement his curveball, and Luis Castillo has a similar thing, and it's a slider that has a lot, he throws a lot harder, you throw a gyro a lot harder, it's really similar to a cut fastball. You throw the gyro so like a lot harder than a normal slider, and it has a lot more bite vertically than horizontal movement, and it just works so well with Castillo's pitch mix. And Logan Gilbert throws one, Brian Wu throws one, it's just kind of a thing on this team. But I love Luis Castillo's changeup too. It's a good out pitch, but his fastball is just the bread and butter strike throwing pitch. I think he got a little zapped by the home run last year on his fastball. I feel like he got a little bit unlucky, like his home run to fly ball rate went up a decent amount compared to 2022. That was a little bit luck. I think he definitely had some starts last year where the command was lacking, and I think that's just going to happen with a guy like Luis Castillo and the makeup of the pitcher that he is. Like, he's going to have some, like we saw last year, he'll have some games where he'll walk three or four guys on strikeout like nine. The best part about him is usually if he's throwing hard and he has good stuff, if the command's not there, it's still really hard to hit him, and he still kind of finds himself getting a lot of ground balls. And I think that's important going forward. I'm excited to have him be the opening day starter this year. It's really just health with him. He just needs to stay healthy. And the past 3 years, he's been pretty damn healthy for a pitcher. It's just like, it appear in this day and age in baseball, it doesn't really appear to matter what your track record is of health. Any pitcher at any time can go down and be out for the year. And it's ever increasingly more likely. I mean, we're seeing Gerrit Cole is going to be out for a month or two, maybe more. And he's been the most durable pitcher in baseball for 6-7 years now. It's kind of scary to think about, but I think it's not like when I project Luis Castillo, I'm projecting him like he's going to pitch the whole season, and I hope he will. And then Logan Gilbert after them. Logan Gilbert and George Kirby. I'm intrigued to see which one gets the ball on game two of the opening series against the Red Sox, because I feel like they're just so... They're not similar pitchers, but they're similar in their output. Like, I can see... I don't know. They're good at different things. Let's just start with... Let's just go by Fangraphs. Logan Gilbert. Oh, I love Logan Gilbert. This is what? This is year four for Logan Gilbert. I think he's in, like, the Super 2 arbitration, which I don't want to get into right now, but I think year four, he has gotten better since his rookie year. I think last season, his raw numbers didn't look quite as good as the year prior, but his peripherals looked much better than the year before, or at least his expected ERA did, and his K numbers jumped up a little bit last year. He walked a lot less guys last year, and he was super durable like the year prior, 190 innings. That's the thing of those three guys, was last season, they were not only really good, they were super durable. I talked about not taking Julio Rodriguez for granted. We should not take these three guys for granted. And that was what was so painful about last year, is your three best pitchers, who are top 25 pitchers in the league, all pitched healthy, complete seasons. And you missed out on the playoffs. But it's like, that's something we can't take for granted. These guys were in the rotation week in, week out, giving you an opportunity to win the game every time they took the mound. That's something you can't take for granted in this day and age of pitchers' elbows exploding constantly. But Logan, I love him. Just such a vertical approach. He's such a tall pitcher who gets elite extension too, which means he releases the ball super close to home plate. So he doesn't throw the hardest, but his 96 fastball is... from a 6'6 high release point and like elite extension, it's like a 99, 100 mile an hour fastball. It gets up on you. Got a lot of ride. And again, gyro slider works really well on it. Last year, he unveiled his splitter, which was a phenomenal pitch. Beautiful to mix in with his stuff, because his fastball, he gets so behind his four seam fastball. He gets so much ride on it because he's so behind it when he releases it. And the splitter works perfectly. The splitter is perfect, a perfect pitch to play off that fastball, because the splitter is such a vertical down pitch. And it's just, it is great, great to play off that fastball. And his slider and curveball are not chump pitches. Those are also really useful. So I think, again, we're going to see a good year from Logan Gilbert. We can expect really, really good stuff. And then George Kirby is just a unicorn. Is a unicorn pitcher. I love him. I love watching George Kirby pitch. His disdain for throwing balls is something I admire. I admire to care about something as much as George Kirby cares about throwing strikes. Historic year last year. In the minors, in college, we knew about this. The Mariners knew about this. The guy doesn't walk people. And last year it was historic. He had a less than... 1 walks per 9, 0.9 walks per 9 last year, which is absurd, especially in today's game where guys are throwing more wild and walking a lot more guys. George Kirby says, no, absolutely not. I don't walk guys. It's somewhat of a double-edged sword here, for sure, because there's inherently more risk to a guy like this, because just... a guy who wants to throw so many strikes, there's inherently more home run risk, just because you're going to live with your fastball in the zone a lot more, and that generally leads to more home runs rather than chases outside of the zone. But George Kirby is so elite at throwing strikes in the shadow, which is on the edges of the zone for strikes. He doesn't leave much over the plate. He's got such elite command. I think he could buck the trend of, like, it's harder to project those guys, because George Kirby could get super unlucky and have a lot of guys sit on his fastball in the zone and hit a lot of home runs and put up like a 4 ERA this season. Like, that could potentially happen, because it's harder to project a guy who doesn't get a lot of whiffs. Like, he's not an elite K guy. He only struck out, what, 8.1 per 9 last year? That's 23-ish%, which is not an elite K rate. But it comes with a 2.5% walk rate, as well as, like, you just look at where he throws these pitches. It's not a fluke. He's throwing them where he wants, and the velocity and the stuff and the pitch shape is so good that I think he is just such a unique pitcher. I'm not quite as worried about him getting super unlucky with batted balls. because he's just so elite. He dots it up wherever he wants. Like, his curveball really came along last year. His fastball was up a tick from his rookie year. And the best reoccurring pitch every week I saw in, I don't know if I want to say the majors, but maybe close, for this baseball team, though, for the Mariners, was that front door two-seamer to left-handed hitters. It was, he pulled that out every game, and it was so nasty. His knuckleball last year, too, was absurd. I hope he throws a few. I hope he throws a knuckleball, like, a week this year just to kind of mix it up. He's also working on a splitter. I've seen Luis Castillo and Logan Gilbert both talking about George Kirby. Like, this dude can just pick up any pitch he wants and throw it at a really high level. That just seems like the type of guy he is. And again, like Julio, these three guys, we cannot take for granted how special that they are. And George Kirby especially, he's genuinely a unicorn pitcher. I've never seen a pitcher with this elite command. It's Greg Maddux who can throw a 99 mile an hour fastball at times. He sits 96, he can throw it 99. Like, it's elite. I'm really excited to see if he improves at all this year, like if he just keeps getting better, because it's hard to improve. He's only in his second year, and it's hard to improve on the year he had last year. It really is, but I think he can do it. And you know, he's not going to walk guys. I think he walked multiple batters like twice in a game last year or something like that. When he's walking multiple batters in a game, it's like, oh my God, is something wrong? That's how good of a pitcher he is. Those three guys, those three alone give you a top 10 rotation in baseball. Honestly, doesn't matter who the last two are. But then you have Bryce Miller and Brian Wu. Both y'all are probably familiar with. Came up last year and impressed. They had pretty rookie seasons last year. They came from the middle of the season. They looked really good out of the break. The league kind of, they got more data on them. They figured them out a little bit. And by the end of the year, you look at their stats and it's like league average. But you take the highs and you ride them out into this year. And Bryce Miller, the easiest comp for Bryce Miller is Logan Gilbert. He, similarly to Gilbert, throws that fast, has such a high release point and throws that fastball with so much backspin that it rises through the zone. And Bryce Miller's fastball is one of the best spin rate fastballs in the league. Super unique pitch. And he's also working on a splitter. And it looks nasty. The splitters he's thrown in spring training have been awesome. And it's the same with Logan. It plays so well off the backspin fastball. That splitter, I think, is going to be a crucial pitch for him this year. I think he's going to have a sweeper slider to go along with it this year to really take another step. But I'm perfectly fine with him being at the back of this rotation and working on stuff still. But that fastball and the splitter will likely get him a long way this year. And I'm super, super hyped to watch a full season of him pitch. I'm just excited. And then Brian Wu, I waffle back and forth on who I think is going to have a better career, because they're different pitchers, but they both seem to have super high ceilings, and the Mariners have done such good work with these guys. Brian Wu, I don't know. Brian Wu, I feel like his athletic delivery, I feel like he's going to be a better pitcher than Bryce Miller, but I'm not going to promise that. Brian Wu, super impressive season last year coming up, especially the circumstances. I mean, he took him out of Cal Poly in like the sixth or seventh round a few years ago, and he was hurt. He had Tommy John surgery at the time, and I think they really loved just his stuff, particularly his fastball. His fastball is a potentially elite fastball in Major League Baseball for interesting reasons, because it is, and I talked about this. Who did I talk about this about? I don't remember, but in one of my previews, wow, I'm really blanking. I talked about the concept of a low release point rising fastball through the zone and how special that can be. And Brian Wu has that. He has a super athletic delivery, but his release is pretty low to the ground compared to average. It's like, look at Bryce Miller and Logan Gilbert, and they're super high on the clock release point. And then look at like Luis Castillo and Brian Wu. They're a lot closer to a sidearm release. They're not quite sidearm, but it's a low release point. And his fastball is not particularly elite in terms of the spin. It's not particularly elite in terms of the velocity. He throws it like 90 596. And he can definitely touch the upper 90s, but like a lot of guys can do that in the league now. What makes it special is the shape. And I talked about this. The shape is special because it's coming in at such a low release point and entering the zone with so much ride. It just sneaks up on pitchers and gets past them and has such a unique vertical break on it compared to a lot of fastballs. That's how special it is. And he throws it really hard. To really get a sense of this and like the impact on a low release fastball and like what like induced vertical break can be, if you look at a fastball that's not particularly elite in spin or stuff, it can be elite if you have a unique release point like this. I implore you to go look up how Joe Ryan throws baseballs, particularly his fastball. His fastball is really good and performs as one of the better run value fastballs in the league. And it's very similar to Brian Wu's. If you watch their deliveries, they're really similar. And it's the low release point rise through the zone that makes it good. And Brian Wu throws that fastball harder than Joe Ryan. Joe Ryan only throws his fastball like 93, 94. And you look at that and it's like, that's not a good fastball, but it is because of the pitch shape. And Brian Wu's is really similar, except he throws it harder. And he also, similar to Logan, not quite as much, but he gets good extension too. So the perceived velocity is definitely harder than like 95 where he sits. I love Brian Wu. The big boogeyman for him this season is left-handed hitters. He got crushed by them last year, and his cutter slash, it's a cutter on Fangraphs kind of, but it's a slider on Baseball Savant. So I think it's a gyro slider. I think he said it's a gyro slider and not a cutter. So I just talked about this, similar to the cutter. So if he throws it hard, it has not very much horizontal movement, but it breaks late. And that is the cutter gyro slider is the pitch that right-handed hitters should be trying to throw down and into lefty bats to get them out. And that, I think that pitch is going to be his crucial pitch this year because his fastball is going to be great. And he threw a changeup last year. That could be a valuable pitch against left-handed pitchers too. But I think the cutter gyro slider thing that he throws could be a really good out pitch against lefties. He just can't leave it up in the zone. That's the big thing. It's like, no matter how good the pitch is, you can't really leave it up in the zone. It kind of has to be low out of the zone to get lefties out or to get them to whiff. He's going to have to figure that out this year because that is the only thing from last season that was really bad was left-handed hitters. They slugged like 700 against him or something crazy. So I think that is the crucial pitch for him this year is that cutter, whatever it is, cutter, gyro slider, whatever you want to call it. That is crucial because I think that can be the out pitch against lefties this season and moving forward. So can like his sinker. He started to throw a little bit more last year. Similar, like where he needs to locate it better because a low and in sinker to a lefty, they're going to destroy. So he needs to keep that low and outside. I think Luis Castillo does a good job with his sinker pitching to lefties. Brian Wu can definitely learn from that. But really, I think he's going to take a step this year. I think it's just the lefty hitters he's got to figure out. But this rotation is so talented. It's insanely talented. And then you move to the bullpen, and it's a little shaky at the moment. Andrés Muñoz is back. He's entering the season healthy. His velocity has been like peak Muñoz in spring, which is really encouraging. He's thrown that slider like 91 miles an hour. I think he's going to be awesome if he stays healthy this year. And then as of right now, the opening day bullpen is supposed to look something like this. Andrés Muñoz, Ryan Stanek, who again is fine. They just signed him. He has a lot of experience. I think he's going to be a fine relief pitcher. Gabe Spier, breakout last year. Love Gabe Spier. I think he's going to be great again this year. And then you get into the like so-so kind of range of Trent Thornton, Taylor Saucedo, Cody Bolton, and Austin Voth. Austin Voth is supposedly going to be the long man slash they're going to try to stretch him into a starter, which is super interesting. And like Trent Thornton, his stuff is really good. It's just kind of about wrangling it. Like he is an elite sweeper. He seems like a classic 2024 relief pitcher. He is an elite sweeper. I think he's going to be pretty useful. Taylor Saucedo pitched so much last year. I think he's going to be fine this season. And I think it's good that they can produce like pretty average to slightly above average relief pitchers like him. I don't have much to say about Cody Bolton, to be honest with you. And then the other one that Fangraphs has in here is Tyson Miller. And Tyson Miller, I knew nothing about going into this spring. And then I saw him pitch, and everyone on Mariners Twitter saw him pitch and was like, hold on, is that Paul Sewald? It's not identical, but it's so similar to Paul Sewald that you gotta go watch him. Tyson Miller, I think he's going to have an impact on the bullpen this year. I think the Mariners, for the same reason they liked Paul Sewald, like Tyson Miller. It looks so similar. It's such a funky sidearm slot with breaking stuff. And he's an intriguing arm to watch this year. It's tough going through this bullpen and knowing that two of your best arms are hurt at the moment. The other one being Jackson Cower, who is out for the year with Tommy John, which sucks because he was probably going to be an intriguing, at least intriguing arm in the bullpen this year. He's out for the year. But obviously who I'm talking about is Matt Brash and Gregory Santos. Matt Brash has elbow inflammation, and I know he just started throwing on a mound again, which is good. The Mariners didn't seem super concerned about this. I mean, the guy throws a high 90s fastball with the most vicious murder slider in baseball. So I'm not surprised his elbow's barking at him a little bit. He's throwing off a mound right now. He's not going to be healthy for opening day, but hopefully we see him in April, but I doubt they'll push him. I mean, he threw 70-plus innings last year. I think he appeared in the most games as a pitcher in the league last year. He was awesome, one of the best pitchers in the game, and we wish him back as soon as possible. And then Gregory Santos, their randomly good reliever acquisition in February. Also, he has a lat injury. When Gregory Santos is pitching, Munoz, Brash, Gregory Santos is one of the better back of the bullpens in the league. I would say the division, but the Astros exist. But those three is a really nice three. And then you throw in like Gabe Spire as the lefty of that group. And that's a nice, nice makeup for the back of the bullpen for the 7th, 8th, and 9th inning. But they're hurt. And Gregory Santos with the lat, I don't know where he's at right now. I think he's getting an MRI. Lat is one of those tough things. From what I understand in baseball, the oblique and lat type injuries is like so tough because you're out for a while, you can't throw or hit. And then you try again, and if it hurts, you got to rest for another couple weeks. It's just one of those. And so hopefully he's not out for too long. I think the bullpen can hold water until those two guys get back. Brash seems like he'll be back before Santos. But the anticipated debut of Gregory Santos will have to wait for probably, I'm assuming, at least a few weeks, probably all of April, I'm guessing, but I'm not exactly sure. Other than that, I think this bullpen is going to be fine. I think, again, I've talked about this ad nauseum. There's a few teams in the league where it's like if there's some random ass minor league or waiver claim arms that they'll turn into a good reliever, it's the Mariners. There's a few teams like this, and the Mariners are thankfully one of them. A guy like Tyson Miller is a good example. But then there's at least a lot of interesting arms in AAA, and this takes me to my AAA impact pitchers portion of the show. And Carlos Vargas is one of those really interesting arms. Got him back in that Diamondbacks trade. Absolute flamethrower. His stuff is crazy. I think we'll definitely see him pitch for the Mariners this year at some point. He's one of these just guys who starts in AAA. And, I mean, if he can figure out the command, that'd be a really scary pitcher. And then they also have like Eduardo Bizardo, we saw last year a little bit. He's hurt right now too, but he'll be in AAA this year. Mauricio Yovera, who I think was a waiver claim. Ty Adcock, we saw a little bit last year. They signed Kirby Snead, veteran, to a minor league contract this year. Travis Kuhn has been in the system for a while, putting up good numbers down in Arkansas. Ty Buttrey, Casey Lawrence, Colin Snyder, Levi Stout, who could be a depth starter this year. traded. He was in the Luis Castillo trade, and now he's back on the Mariners after a tough, tough stint with the Cincinnati Reds. There's plenty of arms here. I'm not super worried about the depth of arms. It's really just like the Brash and Santos injuries where I think they're going to be fine depth-wise. They're going to get enough bullpen innings. They're going to need Munoz, Brash, and Santos to be pretty healthy all year if they really want to push to win this division, because you need that secure back of the bullpen, which I think those guys can be, but they're hurt, so who knows. And then the noteworthy prospects for this year that are farther off from pitching on this team, but we've seen guys go from Double A to the Mariners a few times the past couple of years, and it's almost always pitching because their lab is down there. And two guys I just want to talk about right now, not super long, is Jimmy Joyce and Troy Taylor. I think both of them are super interesting. I think they'll both probably start the year in Double A. Troy Taylor made it up to Double A last year, I think, but he's been in Everett for a while, and then Jimmy Joyce has been in Double A. Both those guys, just intriguing arms that I wouldn't be super surprised at seeing this year if injuries get bad or if those guys just end up progressing in the pitching lab to new heights and Cody Bolton and Austin Voth and Trent Thornton don't work out, or Tyson Miller doesn't work out in the bullpen. Wouldn't be super surprised seeing either of those names pop up in the major leagues for this team. But that's the pitching staff. That is the staff. And that is essentially it for this preview podcast, except I got to do the over-under and the prediction. And I got to go back to my AL West tab to see what their over-under is. Their over-under is 87.5. I'm going to just blindly take the over in hopes that they win more than 87 games. I think there's more than 87 wins in here. But I think it's injuries. It really is injuries. It's if Mitch Garver and Jorge Polanco and Julio J.P. Cal all play 130-plus games, I think, and the pitching staff stays fairly healthy like they did last year, I think they win 90 games. Again, similar like they have done the past couple years. I think there's a 95-win team in here. I also think there's like a 78-win team in here. The depth concerns me. In the lineup, the depth really does concern me, and a couple injuries to this pitching staff like can happen to any team in baseball at a moment's notice, and things could go awry. I like the depth of like Emerson Hancock, but are we forgetting that Darren McCaughan, Tacoma Rainier's legend, is no longer on the team as a depth starter? I mean, how's that going to impact the team this year? The Darren McCaughan factor. I don't know. But I'm going to take the over. I think I'm going to take the over. And I think I'm still going to predict the Astros to win this division. I just feel like the Mariners, I'm going to predict them to get second. And then Rangers, Angels, A's after that. I feel like the Astros are better. But they're I think they're more vulnerable than they have been in recent years. I think them as... they have a better lineup for sure than the Mariners, but I think the Mariners have the edge on the pitching staff and not the bullpen. I think the Astros bullpen is better, but I think the Astros are also have kind of a depth-ish issue. I see some depth being a problem for them this year, similar to the Mariners. So I think it's going to be another close division, unfortunately. I really wish there was more buy-in from ownership to really just like cement this team as like a 95-plus win squad, but they're unfortunately not. Either way, I'm really looking forward to watching Mariners baseball again. I am looking forward to seeing what Jorge Polanco and Mitch Garver can do as Mariners. I'm looking forward to seeing if JP can still just basically do what he did last year and be perfect. Can Cal Raleigh improve? Can he hit 35 home runs this year? Is Julio going to, you know, do the Acuna and cut his walk rate or cut his strikeout rate in half and put up 8 WAR? Who knows? But I'm so looking forward to watching the pitching staff and the development of Bryce Miller and Brian Wu. And I think this team is going to be relevant all year. Again, I think they need a good start. I think they need a strong April. But I'm just going to say this is a good team with flaws that can definitely be addressed at the deadline if need be. I think they have interesting prospects that could impact the team this year. I think they're in a good spot. It could be better. It could be worse. But point is, I'm just looking forward to baseball being back And that was it. That was it for the preview podcasts. Seven of them in about, 5 weeks. That was fun. I love doing this. And the next podcast you'll hear from me, the season will have started. This is going to be the last one before the season officially begins on the 28th in 1 week's time. And I'm so excited. And thank you for listening. And strap in, because I will be podcasting all year talking about the Seattle Mariners. But I'll leave you at that. Thank you so much for listening to this episode, to any of the other previews. And look out for, you know, regular podcasts about the Seattle Mariners during the season. But thank you for listening. Have a good rest of the week leading up to opening day. And one last go Mariners before the season begins. Thanks, everyone.